Chapter 3. South American nitrate was a good fertilizer, but the fast-growing and increasingly hungry European nations during the Industrial Revolution fixed their attention not on the desert, but to the sea a few hundred miles north of the Tarapacá, to a place where there were mountains of the most perfect and powerful natural fertilizer ever found. During the 20 years from the 1840s to the 1860s, it fueled national economies, determined foreign policy, caused a war, and earned a lasting reputation as one of the world's oddest industries. The first thing approaching sailors saw was a pale yellow pall over the water. As their ships drew closer, the islands came in sight, a few whitish dots on the horizon, then wheeling clouds of seabirds. Closer still, if the wind was right, the sailors could smell it, the rich scent of newly turned earth, an undertone of low tide on a hot day, a bit of old outhouse and rotting fish, and a sharp tang of urine. To sailors who had been at sea for a few months, the odor might have seemed interesting for a few minutes. After a few days anchored near the islands, it would grow unbearable. Closer still, they could make out the line of shanties on the island's snowy tops. The smell grew stronger. Then a guide-boat came out to lead them to their anchorage, and they eased into a forest of masts bobbing around the rocks. Each ship took its place in line and waited. It could take weeks, rolling on the jade-green water, trying to ignore the stench, before they took their turn for loading. The only way to speed things up was to bribe the island's governor. The only landing spot was a ledge in front of a great sea cave, hollowed out of the 100-foot-high cliffs. The swells rose and crashed on the rocks. Visitors had to time their leap from boat to ledge perfectly, jumping at the top of the rise. Supplies were handed into baskets and lifted to the top with winches and tackle. Visitors had to crisscross their way up systems of trails and ladders that snaked up the cliffs. At the top was the palace, a flat-roofed wooden shanty furnished with rough cots, a few writing desks, some German maps, and a couple of old pistols hanging on the walls. A large dog panted in the yard. The boss of the islands was a red-haired, epithet-spewing Hungarian. It was to him that the ship captains came courting, one after another, bearing gifts of sardines, cold hams, and bottles of wine in a bid to buy a faster loading time. From one side of the governor's house, wrote a visitor, the view was enchanting. Imagine the Andes and the Pacific in one view. The islands with their precipitous walls, indented with immense caves and surrounded by fantastic rocks, fringed with foam, the pure ocean air, the myriads of seabirds, the shipping, the schools of sea lions, and almost always, far or near, upon the blue waste, the spout of whales, and the white sails of ships coming or departing. Altogether, the scene is full of exhilaration and excitement. Out the other side, the side with the pistols hanging near the windows, the scene was more like something from Dante's Inferno. The slaves were half-dressed, most of them with rags tied around their heads and over their mouths. Their skins were white with dust. They dug, shoveled, and pushed under the watch of armed guards, who clubbed or whipped them if they slowed. The sun through the dust was blinding. There were no trees to provide shade. There was only the smell, the heat, and everywhere the screaming of birds. These were the Chinchas Islands, a sprinkling of rocks 6 miles off the coast of Pisco, Peru, which constituted in 1850, acre for acre, the most valuable real estate on earth. The value came from the ground the workers and the birds walked on. 10 stories of guano, the world's best fertilizer. The ground everywhere was springy to the step. Deep down, when the workers dug into it, it turned a rusty red. Some of the workers, about 600 of them, all from China, coolies, tricked or coerced into signing long-term labor contracts that made them virtual slaves, picked and shoveled the dusty guano into wheelbarrows. The others ran the wheelbarrows to the edge of the cliffs and dumped them into canvas chutes that funneled the guano directly into the holds of ships far below. Visitors were appalled by what they found in the chinchas. The coolies lived almost naked under the tropical sun. No days of rest, one observer wrote, in huts made of reed, surviving on two small meals a day, usually maize or rice, and a few bananas. On good days, they might get a little meat. They worked up to 20 hours a day, 6 days a week, in intense heat and choking dust that never settled, because here, along the same coast as the Tarapacá, it almost never rained. Up to a quarter of the workforce at a time would be too sick to work, from exhaustion, exposure, malnutrition, and something called guano-handling illness, which included some combination of shortness of breath, coughing up blood, fainting, swollen legs, cramps, vomiting, and diarrhea. Scurvy was common. Sometimes a trench in the guano would cave in, and a few would be buried alive. Any coolies who did not meet their quota of 100 wheelbarrow loads a day had to make up on Sunday, their only day of rest. If their hands were too sore and blistered to hold a shovel, they were yoked to the wheelbarrows like mules. There was a prison ship off one of the islands where sailors loading guano could see 8 or 10 coolies at a time hanging en masse in the sun without food or water for infractions as minor as refusing an order. Others were punished by being tied to buoys where the sea washed over them all day, or chained to small leaky boats and forced to bail to stay alive. An outraged British visitor wrote, "No hell has ever been conceived of by the Hebrews, the Irish, the Italian, or even the Scotch mind for appeasing the anger or satisfying the vengeance of their awful gods that can be equaled with the fierceness of the heat, the horror of the stink, and the damnation of those compelled to work there." Until their contracts were paid off, there was only one way out. Some coolies killed themselves with opium or drink. There was a thriving drug trade in the camps. Others threw themselves off cliffs or simply swam out in the sea. Dead coolies were buried like dogs, one visitor noted, in shallow graves scratched out of the guano. No one knows exactly how many died. Sometimes their bones were found strewn around the surface, dug up and scattered by guard dogs. For this, the coolies were paid 3 reales, about a third of a peso, a day, 2 of which were withheld for meals. The contracts, held by Peruvian overseers, usually lasted 5 years. Guano was big money for Peru. For a few years, income from its sales supplied most of the Peruvian national budget, and few Peruvians would work on the island, so they bought into the coolie trade, with a few wealthy families making money on contracts for the Chinese as well as the fertilizer. Visiting ship captains and their crews hated the guano trade. At its height, more than 100 ships at a time might be waiting to load at one of the few places they could at the 2 largest islands. When their turn finally came, the barrel loads of guano hurtling down into their holds raised clouds of dust so foul that most of the crew escaped by climbing into the rigging, coughing. The ships, mostly from England and the United States, were covered in yellow dust. Sailors, unlucky enough to draw duty as a trimmer, leveling the deep piles of guano in the hold, could work no more than 20 minutes at a time, even with damp cloths tied around their mouths and noses, before clambering out, gasping for breath. Some got nosebleeds, some were temporarily blinded. The guano ship's crews drank heavily, brawled, and at the height of the trade threatened so much trouble that the U.S. Pacific Fleet was ordered to patrol the area to maintain order among the unruly merchant seamen. They were once holy islands. For 1,000 years, the Incas and the tribes before them had paddled from the mainland to the rocks with their living white crowns of birds, to collect the earth, a powdery substance that, when dug into their fields, made the corn grow in abundance. They called the powerful earth Huanu. They ranked it with gold as one of the god's most precious gifts and made holy sanctuaries of the island where it was found. Visiting was forbidden when the birds were breeding. Killing a seabird in the area was an offense punishable by death. The Indians understood what they had, but it took Europeans a while to figure it out. The Spanish first heard about Huanu, which they spelled guano, from the 16th century son of an Inca princess and a Spanish conquistador who informed Madrid that there were islands composed almost entirely of bird guano that from afar appeared like the peaks of some snowy mountain range. He reported, "There is much fertility in this bird manure." His letter was ignored for 2 centuries as the Spanish focused their attention on looting the area's gold and silver. Even after German naturalist and explorer Alexander von Humboldt, the man after whom the Humboldt current is named, collected a lump of Peruvian guano and brought it back to Europe early in the 19th century, it took a while to appreciate what had been found. Humboldt, accompanied by a French botanist who saw amazingly fertile fields in arid Peru, heard that farmers had used guano for 1,000 years and appreciated a local proverb, "Guano, though no saint, works many miracles." Humboldt's guano was analyzed, and the chemist reported that it was extraordinarily high in urea and phosphates, a finding that seemed to excite almost no interest scientifically or economically. When the first small commercial shipment of a few barrels of guano, shipped out by an enterprising Peruvian, arrived in England a few years later, it found no buyers and was dumped into the Thames. In 1813, the outstanding English chemist Humphrey Davy did his own analysis and reported that while guano was high in ammonia and urea, the dung of seabirds has, I believe, never been used as a manure in this country. That was about to change. In 1824, the editor of American Farmer magazine told his readers that a midshipman aboard the USS Franklin had arrived in port in Baltimore carrying, quote, among other valuable and curious things, close quote, a small amount of, quote, that celebrated manure guano dung possessing such astonishing fertilizing properties, close quote. Some of it made its way to the governor of Maryland, who tried it on his farm. He found it to be the most effective manure he had ever applied to corn. Word spread. In 1838, 2 Peruvian businessmen forwarded more guano samples to Liverpool, where most encouraging results were obtained among local farmers. A Scottish farmer reported that the substance boosted his yields 30%. Others talked of barren fields being brought back to life and trees blooming twice a year. The Earl of Derby purchased an entire shipload. A market for the stinking stuff built rapidly. Ports in England began experiencing what Southampton did when the first guano ships arrived. A stench so foul, as one observer reported, the entire town took to the hills. The smell was nothing, however, compared with the demand. American plantation owners, many of whose cotton and tobacco fields were playing out, found that applications of guano could restore their fortunes. The only problem with it was that the South American guano was so powerful, it had to be applied carefully to avoid burning crops. By the 1840s, they were buying all the Peruvian product they could and started looking to other sources. By far the best guano in the world came from the Chinchas Islands. The Peruvian government, shaky as it was, the government went through 2 dozen changes of regime between 1824 and 1841, began to realize what the Incas had known centuries before. Guano was as valuable as gold. The more they could sell in foreign markets, the more money would flow in to prop up whatever government was in power. The Chinchas were nationalized, with the government taking control of harvesting and shipping, handing out licenses for the coolie trade, levying taxes, and making a great deal of money. Rather than dirtying its hands, developing the guano trade on its own, Peru sold contracts for the work to foreign firms in exchange for large advances on potential profits. The firms shipped coolies in and guano out. Money began to roll. The guano boom was on. Guano this, best of all possible manures, became like a necessity of life to us, wrote a British farmer, an all but indispensable fertilizer. A U.S. expert estimated it was 35 times more powerful than standard barnyard manure. A man identified as one of George Washington's nephews said, I have never seen a worn-out or poor soil on which it would not, if properly applied, bring good crops. Farmers Magazine enthused. If ever a philosopher's stone, the elixir of life, the infallible Catholicism, the universal solvent, or the perpetual motion were discovered, it is the application of guano in agriculture. Annual shipments grew to hundreds of thousands of tons per year in the United States and as much in Great Britain. Its availability became a matter of national policy. In 1850, President Millard Fillmore, in his first State of the Union address, noted that Peruvian guano has become so desirable an article to the agricultural interests in the United States that it is the duty of government to employ all the means properly in its power for the purpose of causing that article to be imported into the country at a reasonable price. In 1854, 20,000 Delawareans asked Congress to buy one of the Peruvian guano islands, arguing that the purchase of one of those islands would be to the people of the United States of more solid worth than that of Cuba and all of the Antilles besides. Diplomatic relations with Peru were, as a result, maintained at a level of extreme cordiality. During the 10 years following Fillmore's comment, use from the United States tripled. Farmers, despite steadily rising prices, found it difficult to do without it. Use in Great Britain and France rose almost as fast. About a third of the sale price of every ton of guano went into the treasury of Peru, a flow of income that by 1859 accounted for three-quarters of the nation's national budget. As one observer wrote, a stranger means of defraying nearly the whole expenditure of the state was never before heard of. The Peruvian leaders used the enormous income and the promise of future income as collateral to leverage foreign loans, fueling a brief Gilded Age highlighted by a bloated civil service and inflated military. Wealthy Peruvians built mansions, hired servants, and imported the styles, frills, and trappings of wealthy Europeans. The streets of Lima were decorated with dashing officers in gaudy uniforms and beautiful women in the latest Paris fashions. Government officials involved in overseeing the guano trade, often members of the nation's leading families, became rich from the trade and the bribes that went with it. As for stealing, wrote a British critic of the trade, it may be safely said that nearly all public men have steeped themselves to the neck in this crime, and the common people take to it as easily and naturally as birds in a garden take to sweet berries. As long as the money lasted, it looked as if Peru, as one enthusiastic observer wrote in 1857, was destined to become at once the richest and happiest nation on earth. And then it was over. By the late 1850s, the coolies on the Chinchas began to hit rock. The deposits of thousands of years had been stripped away in less than two decades. Traders began looking for the next Chinchas. Any deserted rock with flocks of birds represented a possible fortune. Small guano companies, some of them little more than pirates, scoured the globe, occupying any undefended rock, and stripping all the guano they could find. The need was so great that in 1856 the U.S. Congress passed the Guano Islands Act, which allowed any U.S. citizen to lay claim to any deserted guano island anywhere in the world and make it U.S. territory. The law essentially deputized all Americans to claim land in their nation's name, an act that has no parallel in history, as historian Jimmy Skaggs put it. Fly-by-night companies begin taking territory, including much that should never have been claimed. Islands that were inhabited, islands that had no guano, islands that already belonged to other nations, islands they found on old maps, islands they heard about from drunken whaling captains, islands that did not exist. Within a few decades, the United States had claimed under the Act a total of 94 island rocks and keys, many of them sprinkled in that great stretch of the Pacific between Hawaii and Samoa, that later became known as American Polynesia. Others were in the Caribbean. No guano of any quality was gathered from any of these claims. Many of them did, however, serve other purposes. Midway Island, Baker, Johnston, Howland, and other Guano Island Act atolls and islets provided airstrips and staging areas in World War II. One island later became a CIA base and was used to beam anti-communist radio into Cuba. One was dubbed the Toxic Waste Disposal Center of the World because of the nerve gas and other chemical weapons stored there. One big enough to contain a coconut plantation was taken over and run for a few decades as a private family kingdom. Eight islands in the Pacific claimed under the Act still belong to the United States. The Guano Island Act is still in effect. As the Chincha's product declined, entrepreneurs tried to disguise inferior guano. Fast-talking hucksters began selling backwoods farmers sacks of sand and gravel mixed with animal droppings and urine under the label Pure Peruvian. They mixed poor guano with the leavings from meatpacking plants or added fish scraps or bone dust and sold it as Pendleton's Guano Compound or Cotton King Superphosphate. The Port of Baltimore finally had to hire a guano inspector to sniff incoming shipments and assess quality. No amount of ballyhoo or mislabeling, however, could hide the result farmers saw in their next crop. Top-grade guano in bulk, it turned out, was an exceedingly rare thing. In most places around the world, too much rain washed out the nitrogen content and lowered quality. Chincha's-level guano was found on only a few rocks with the right mix of abundant seabirds and an arid climate. Nothing else came close. As that fact sank in, as the sources of good fertilizer shrank, the nation's jockeying for guano became more intense. When Daniel Webster, then U.S. Secretary of State, made an ill-fated attempt in the 1850s, to lay claim to a few guano-rich rocks off the Peruvian coast, the incident sparked anti-U.S. riots in Lima and the dispatching of Peruvian troops to the Barren Islands. The United States backed down. A real war started in 1863 when a Spanish naval squadron occupied the Chinchas in a move both ill-advised and ill-timed. The end of Chincha's guano was already in sight, and the Spanish occupation, made by an arrogant and hot-tempered admiral, kicked off declarations of war by both Peru and its neighbor Chile. The two former colonies combined their navies under the command of a talented former Confederate admiral from Virginia and succeeded in capturing a Spanish ship. The humiliated Spanish admiral committed suicide, and his nation withdrew. The Guano War marked South America's true independence from Spain and set off an exuberant two-nation celebration. Toward the end of the guano trade, black birders, pirates who kidnapped Polynesian and Melanesian tribesmen, raided the Easter Islands, shipping 1,000 captured tribespeople to work digging guano. They included about a third of the island's total population, including its chief, crown prince, and most of the priests. It is estimated that 900 of the captured Easter Islanders died in captivity. When the raid became public, an international outcry led to the attempted return of the 100 or so survivors. 85 of them died of disease on their way home. The remainder passed on the disease when they finally arrived home. By 1877, only 111 natives remained in the Easter Islands. By then, the Chinchas were bare. When I first saw them 20 years ago, they were bold, tall, and erect, standing out of the sea like living things reflecting the light of heaven or forming soft and tender shadows of the tropical sun on the blue sea, wrote a nostalgia-addled guano man at the time. Now these same islands looked like creatures whose heads had been cut off, or like vast sarcophagi, like anything in short that reminds one of death and the grave. That was in the 1860s. Today, the chinchas again belong to the birds. Peruvian government restricts access, protects the wildlife, and still allows some limited gathering of what is still the world's best natural fertilizer. The end of guano also meant an end to Peru's easy income. By the 1870s, the nation was, for all practical purposes, bankrupt. About 11 million tons of guano had been gathered, shipped, and spread during the brief guano age. Now that it was over, government officials in Peru faced disaster, and farmers in Europe and America, increasingly hooked on applications of high-quality fertilizer, were facing a return to the bad old days of declining yields. It was then that businessmen, farmers, and politicians remembered that there was another natural source of fertilizer just south of the chinchas. It was called salitre by the locals in the Tarapacá Desert. The traders in Britain called it nitrate. There were hints in the reports of visitors like Darwin that the nitrate might exist in great quantities, covering the ground for miles. There were reports from a few farmers that it could do wonders for crops. At the same time, the leaders of Peru realized that this new source of wealth also belonged almost entirely, by the grace of God, to their nation, for the moment.